In this week, on the 3rd of November 2020, 5 years ago, we played our first game back at Plough Lane. The journey was indeed long. The FA were indeed wrong. But we're Wimbledon. We were back home. Hello, we're the same old Wombles. We're back.
I've been standing here since many years ago. You've been under my skin for as long as I have known. We traveled away and we stand in the rain and the cold. Take the rough with the smooth. If we win or we lose, we just go on.
Hello, every dear listener, and welcome to the Same Old Wombles podcast. Very excited for this particular episode. Like to welcome our regulars. Hello, my friend, Al Cooper. How you doing?
All right, Matt.
And hello to Professor Dr. Adam Proctor. Hello, Adam. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you, Matthew.
And just back from a short stroll around the country, it's the legend that is Xavier Wiggins. How are you, sir? It's so good to see you alive.
Oh, it was a close thing, actually. I was very lucky to be alive after 92 days of generally walking on A roads. It was just the most incredible experience.
And you look amazing. I know that we are fortunate because we get to see you like this right now. And you've told us already you're gonna have a shave and a haircut. But at this particular moment, you look like a lighthouse keeper, which is a beautiful thing. I'd say keep with it.
Yeah, a much lighter lighthouse keeper as well, actually. About three and a bit stone lighter than when I left. So,
oosh.
So yeah. Wow.
So not only is Zav going to be writing a book, he's going to be doing some sort of, you know, diet video as well.
Yeah, oh, the diet. See, the diet's easy. Just eat more. Do whatever you want. Want fish and chips, eat it twice, followed by a deep-fried Mars bar. Nice. But as long as you walk 92 days, you'll be fine.
You'll be all right.
Yeah.
That's incredible. Three stone, that's an insane amount. I'd be like, there'd be nothing left of me. That's amazing.
No, the last person who did it went from... So he did it in 2012, a guy called Paul Hodgkinson. He took 147 days, but he lost 5 stone from 15 stone to 10 stone. And he was in a bit of trouble after it. He had exhaustion and things. So, I've not quite gone that mad.
But that's so you, I'm just working out. Have you broken some sort of record then? Is this the quickest time to get around the 92, walking around the 92 grounds? If he was saying that it was 100, what was the last guy doing?
147 to 92. He's done it 55 days faster. So not only is he just beating it, he's absolutely trounced out of sight, which is just, you know, totally phenomenal. I think why Zav is frozen, Matt?
Yeah, while Zav is frozen, let's get through it as quick as possible.
Was it me frozen?
You were frozen for a minute there, Zav. So we were just thinking we were going to take this opportunity just to reflect very quickly on the weekend.
We lost. Move on.
Yeah, that was it. We lost. It was just, it was really for us. You know, we know that you love hearing a travel story from us. So we were set enough to get there in time, and we got to Waterloo, and all the trains were delayed. So that was telling us something. At that point, we should have gone home. And then we got to Clapham Junction, and there was someone on the tracks, so we were waiting there for like 20 minutes. So by the time we got to the game, it's like half an hour ago, we were already 1-0 down. And everyone had that sort of like feeling. There was a sense amongst the crowd that it just was not going to be, it was not going to be our day. The opposition were, you know, Jake said, God bless them, you know, good luck to them, to be honest with you. They were really up for it. And we just didn't look like anything. And, you know, I think when you bring Orsi on...
I was, you know, thinking about this and knowing that we had the amazing Xavier Wiggins on here, is that obviously we're a great believer in superstition. And what happened is, like, I think while Xav was doing his walk, we're basically on this amazing run and doing fantastic. And as soon as Zab stopped, we turned in a performance like that. And I think Zab probably, I don't know what time he arrived at Plymouth, but it must have been just about kickoff. And so therefore, obviously, the thing is that Zab needs to embark. If we're going to do well this season, Zab needs to embark on another 92 days. And therefore, we might have a chance in the playoffs.
I've got long history of lucky walks. Staines away, Hampton away in the 1-1 draw. I'm not going walking again, though.
Cycling is going to be the next thing, yeah?
No, unicycling. I'd rather walk 92 grounds again than train for London to Brighton and then do London to Brighton. I hate cycling.
Ah, excellent. I can see a challenge already on the horizon. Generally speaking, though, Saturday was rubbish. But not only that, but I think, Adam, you've missed the last two games, haven't you, at Plough Lane?
Yeah. I did, yes.
And we lost them both.
Yeah.
So Nick needs to go on a walk, and Adam needs to attend games.
Yeah.
But the good thing is the next game on the 15th has been postponed, which I couldn't make. So now I can make. And although our next game is now December or something ridiculous, at home.
Yeah.
Well, obviously there's away games, but I can't do any of those at this point in time. But yes, I'll be at home.
I think we should just skip the FA Cup. And let's just talk to Zab, because more interesting than the FA Cup.
I just wanted to bring up one thing that was, two things.
Hang on a minute. Noel just said that's way more interesting than the FA Cup. He was literally having a go at me last week about the fact I didn't care about the FA Cup because I wasn't going to the game. Well, guess what? I didn't go, and I listened to the audio, which was slightly depressing. It wasn't as depressing as you guys arriving late and seeing us get absolutely smashed by a team that has nothing going on. So, whatever.
Okay. All right, Adam. I've got a point well made.
Thank you.
But the one thing now is because it's the whole thing about football fortune, and that is a lot of what our season is based on. So, you know, a good cup run, either in the league or the FA Cup, is good for our finances. And now we don't have that, which means, do we have to care about the EFL trophy? It's 10K a win. And if the further we progress in it, the more money we make. And the next game we've got is, I think it's next Tuesday against Bromley. And it's a winner takes all. So the winner gets through to the next round. And we've already got a bit of a rep with Bromley. So the thing is, do we now have to care about that purely on a financial level? More than anything else.
We have to care about finances anyway, like from the get-go. That's why, although I was not excited about this round of the FA Cup, what I wanted was for us to take the cash. And so, yeah, we have to take as much money as we can from these various events as possible. So, yeah. But I think the league is still the most important thing for us. Staying in League One continues up. The amount of investment we can get, the kind of sponsors we can get, it's a longer term game. Winning a bunch of cup games is a short term thing, and that's not going to plug any of the big gaps that supposedly we have in our finance scenario. But I do think we need to ensure that we stay in League One, and because that's a big thing for us.
Yeah, I agree. And obviously, if we can get into the playoffs, hey, why not dream? Then that would be great. But I mean, a couple of games, and into the third round of the FA Cup would have given us a whack of money.
Have they done the next draw? They haven't done the draw yet, have they?
Yeah.
The next teams.
Yeah.
Were they?
Yep. So.
Oh, okay.
If we'd have got through, we'd have had Walsall at home. So, not exactly a. I don't think. And to be honest, I don't think anyone wanted to play Walsall again. So you know. There you are, yin yang, yeah. But anyhow, so that's it. So next week we've got the EFL Trophy, and obviously on Saturday we've got Peterborough away. And I think my understanding is we're already taking over 1,000 people up there, and obviously, Zav, I don't know if you're going this time, but you, mate,
I am. Yeah, just looking forward to it.
Take a train, take a lift, take a word. Just leave the walking boots behind.
I will be doing that, definitely. And I think I'll go to Bromley as well, because you're right. It's turned into a reasonably significant game now. We can't go out of the World Cups in the first round. That was silly.
Yeah, I know. It's gonna be tricky. If Bromley is the closest ground to us, I think it'd be silly for us not to go and support. Although I really have such bad memories of that place. But Zav, I have to say, mate, you are looking so well. You're looking really well. And it's incredible that you've done this amazing trip. I know that between Niall and I, we've got sort of like different variety of questions we'd like to ask. I'm really keen to know, the logistics of it. How long this amazing walk? 92 grounds, 91 grounds, and in 92 days. How long did it take you to plan it all? When did that idea come about?
So I was never going to be the one walking. A mate of mine, Simon, lives in Wimbledon, but he's actually an Arsenal fan. He came up with the idea of Walk 92, and we had somebody with lived experience of homelessness who was going to walk it. So he'd come through homelessness, he'd become a football coach, had worked with the Street Soccer Foundation, who tackle youth homelessness, and honestly, we felt we had a real duty of care to him, and we didn't feel that, it's a very demanding thing, and we didn't feel that he was going to be able to do it. So that suddenly meant that we needed to go and find somebody, and I thought, well, I can't be bothered doing that, because how am I going to go? That's going to take ages finding someone stupid enough to walk 92 grounds in 92 days. So I just thought, I'll do it. So I had a chat with my wife, came up with about 200 reasons not to do it, and then ignored them all, and then set about trying to get a route. So Simon found randomly a Canadian mapping software company called Safe. Spoke to them. They did the initial route. I've actually got a T-shirt in my cupboard that says 3,250 miles, 35 miles a day. I believe that is physically impossible, having experienced 23 miles a day. But that was our opening gambit on distance.
Whoosh.
And then we mixed it in with some AI, then some Google Maps, and then about 15, 20 hours of conversations between three of us. And we arrived at a route that was that seemed more reasonable. It seemed like a couple of thousand miles. And then each day, basically, like often, I'd just leave the hotel, I'd stick my Google Maps on, and I'd head in the direction it was telling me to do. And if I got to a hideous road, and there was anything like an alternative, I'd do the alternative, as long as it didn't add on too much time. But I guess the big thing that I hadn't predicted was how many horrible roads there were going to be, where I was just literally walking in the road. It was like being in a computer game with kind of juggernauts coming towards me and jumping onto the verge. I pictured the creation of this video game, by the way, because I think I've lived it. It's pretty bonkers, but the mapping took a long time, and we didn't get it right. I don't think there's a perfect way of doing it, but we got it as good as we could.
So there was a lot of walking along A roads when you were doing this.
There was so much. I've actually got a really good film. I hadn't in all of my kind of updates, I was very aware that my mum was watching this, and I really didn't want her sitting on the edge of her seat for 92 days, wondering whether I'd be alive for our next update in the evening. So I didn't shout overly about how bad it was. But anyway, my mate, who's a journalist, he couldn't help himself. So we were walking together, and he was pretty blown away by the sort of conditions we were walking in. And he's got a really good film that shows how brutal it was. But it was clearly there were some beautiful walks, but there were a lot of really bad ones. And it's not just A roads, it can be B roads, but with when you've got no paths, it's if I had the big rucksack, which was my kind of 10-kilo rucksack, which more often than not was taken from A to B for me, which was nice. But if you got the perfect storm of that, rubbish roads and crappy weather, then that wasn't really a good day. But you can't, you know, you just got to get on with it. But it was, it was mad trying to organize the route.
Wow.
And I'm just really interested to have, obviously, that there've got to be moments when you would have felt like you just want to give up, but equally,
yeah,
you know, you've gone to 92, and within that, there must have been some absolutely amazing stories and amazing things. So it's just, you know,
yeah,
when you get the chance to, you're sitting down and you finally got your feet up,
yeah,
what would be the, you know, three or four like really standout memories of that experience?
There's so many now. First of all, I never even considered for 1 second giving up. Genuinely, I just got up in the morning, 7:30, and went. If it was raining, I stuck my hood up. If the road was bad, I just marched on. But I never considered, and I had some tough moments throughout it, but I never considered not doing it. So, but the and partly because of, you know, how special it was, seeing what people were doing. I mean, obviously some of the big clubs were doing amazing things. Man City helping 17,000 young people on their pathways for an average of 24 hours a year. That's all cool. Some of the big clubs, big club foundations were doing good things. But my perfect day in the context of this, my perfect day was Port Vale. So I went from Port Vale to Stoke. But Port Vale, so what would usually happen is I'd arrive at the ground, I would go in, I'd take a picture pitch side, and I'd interview the foundation person, whoever it was. Sometimes it was the CEO, sometimes it wasn't. And I would ask them about one of their programs. And at Port Vale, I was with Mickey Lonergan, another Wimbledon fan. He did 13 legs with me. And we were both kind of heading into the stands and down onto the pitch side, and Mickey was behind me and he said, "That was Ronan Curtis. I've just seen him." And I'd completely forgotten that he was there. So I said, "Oh, let's go and get him." So we went to get him, and then as we were going to get him, Ben Hennigan wanders out the dressing room, and so we had Ben Hennigan and Ronan Curtis. So we got pictures there, right? That's just the start of it. Then had the pictures, did an interview, then went into the back into the stand, and there was this Golden Valiance event going on. So their senior citizens, the isolation program they have, there are 120 in there with a couple of the liveliest, most engaged players you're ever going to get. The whole atmosphere in there was fantastic. I had people walking up to me and giving me money because people were kind of talking about me being there and stuff. And then I met the CEO, who at Port Vale is an ex-community director, which is very unusual, and had a great chat with him.
Brilliant.
Yeah, really, really good. And as I was chatting to him, through wanders Carol Shanahan, right, who basically, her opening gambit was, "Hello, good to meet you. Would you like a biscuit?" And she'd made some biscuits. She's just like, you know, really nice. And I said, Mick and I said yes, and we went into her office. And she was the, you know, she's the owner of the club, and we talked about why she bought it 6 years ago. She had a company with 360 staff, and she felt that Burslem was really, really struggling. She wanted to give it some pride back, and just built this fantastic community club where they all sit together, the foundation, the staff, they're all together. They have the additional positive of players trained there as well. And so it's all, you've got the players, you've got the gym, you've got the training grounds, you've got the foundation, you've got the club, and they're all together. So it felt really special. And then I wandered after that fantastic experience, I wandered down the canal and interviewed Lou Macari at Stoke about his homeless projects, and then the Stoke community arm as well. So that was pretty special. Another one was Chesterfield. So I just thought that their work was so good. I saw them at the end of the day, so I didn't rush off. And they've got this program called Boots on the Ground, where the Chesterfield Town Centre has had a real kind of crime problem. And now the foundation go in with the police on a Friday night. They speak to young people, they try to get to understand them a bit better and maybe signpost them and things. And anyway, over the last 4 years, town centre crime has gone down 60%, like partly as a result of this Boots on the Ground program. So that was fantastic. And then you see Millwall working with Job Centre Plus, West Ham in GP surgeries, Tottenham doing entrepreneurship stuff. Of course, Wimbledon doing good things as well. And I just saw, I mean, I was buzzing before, you know me, guys. I'm genuinely reasonably positive, generally, and this just buoyed me further. I just can't wait to continue to shine a light on what all these organisations are doing, because it was pretty special.
So, I mean, this is where, Sav, you know, I mean, for me and what we do at Fair Game is just like, well, you know, such a unity between both the projects about football being a force for good, because it really can be. You know, what people do with the trust and the foundations. And I just think having had the opportunity to see all of those, there's a significant part of me that's a bit jealous of that. But also, you know, to give that light to all of those things, to say, right, actually, there's so much wealth in the top end of football. Yeah. And these foundations and the trust and the work they do and social impact is so often ignored. And it's kind of given second fiddle, and it shouldn't be. And we should be looking at, I'm very, very, very pro giving them so much more money to do the amazing works. I mean, I've touched on a couple of those people that you mentioned there, Sam.
Yeah.
And you can talk to them and say, well, what would you go to do if you doubled your budget? And the amount, like Chesterfield example, I don't know the Chesterfield example, but that is replicated in so many different places. So the reason for your walk and what it's done and the publicity it's given, I just totally take my hats off to you and just think it's brilliant. And, you know, what we're doing at Fair Game, we've just taken the secretariat for the APPG on football. We're bringing together all these other good organisations. And it's like, this is a moment to really, particularly with the regulator, particularly with the financial distribution being up for grabs, to say, this is how football can be so powerful. And I think everything you've done with DLAG, with Sports Local Action, and now with Walk 92 is just like, you know, I know you've got the OBE or whatever, but like, if you go for something fucking knighthood, as far as I'm concerned, I think it's just like brilliant. I'm really, really, really just proud of everything you've done. I mean, you know, it's just exactly what football needs.
It is amazing, well, look, stuff.
Thanks, guys. But there's a hell of a lot more to do. It will be a bit wasted if I don't kick on from here, right? I think we can go further. I liken all of this a little bit to the prison service, right? And 50 years ago, or 30 years ago, 20 years ago, prison was about deterrent and punishment. But then rehabilitation came quite a distant second. Now, the big brains around prisons are realizing that if you put rehabilitation level or just above it, you're gonna get much, much more exciting results. And I think the same can happen with football, particularly kind of championship below that, with looking at impact as level or just above results. Right? When I walk into Stevenage Borough, and you see right there. So you go you go into the main reception, you go left to the foundation, you go right to the club offices, and there's a big sign there that says last year Stevenage Borough delivered £10.9 million worth of impact. That really starts getting exciting. And when I was going around the grounds and I was saying, you know, you're doing all this stuff. Where do you have this front and centre? Is this on your LED boards? Is it in your lobby? Is it in your program? All of the impacts? And most of them said, no, it's not, but it should be, shouldn't it? And So if we can keep reminding people, we did a piece of research through Observant before the walk that showed that 30% of people only could name their club's CCO, and I want that to, you know, clearly I want that to increase dramatically in the next year or two, right? Basically getting that awareness up. But I think it can happen.
So I was going to ask something on that. I mean, there's so much good stuff here that it's quite difficult to kind of work out where to take this. But obviously, you've seen firsthand that the impact that a football club can have in its various communities, and that it can have a big positive impact. I mean, how do you see the next steps in terms of, like, there's so much money in football at the top of the pyramid. How do you see convincing those clubs at the Premier League, etc., to really understand the kind of impact that they can have in a community, that they can have in society, that's beyond the Saturday game? Because obviously those people just talk about, oh, the Saturday game. I mean, I don't know those people really, but I would love to hear more about how you think we could influence the highest paid part of the scheme to realise the potential they have to actually better society.
I think we need to differentiate between club and foundation, right? So at the moment, most clubs, if you ask them, they'd all say that they're good community clubs, right? Bit cynically, I don't believe they know what that means usually. I believe that they might have a really good foundation, or they might have other partners like Don's Local Action or whatever, but I don't believe that the clubs themselves often are brilliant community clubs. And that's not being horrible. That's just like, you know, let's work out what that looks like. Because to me, and I've started compiling a kind of a list of what a brilliant community club might look like, right? And there are some really simple things like community appearances. The average number of player appearances in communities in the EFL was 292, right? So clearly one metric might be, right, well, how many appearances, but it also might be what share of your marketing voice is devoted to talking about community stuff. How closely do you represent your community? You know, if you've got a high BAME population in your area and you've got all white boards, you're not representing really the people from your community. There could be all sorts of things. And actually, I'd really like to just sit down with each club, because it'll all be different, and talk to their various stakeholders and look at what brilliant community club looks like. And in our case, I've said it before, but I don't believe we can plausibly build a plan for the championship. I don't believe we can plausibly build a plan for any kind of, you know, we could spend the rest of my life without another promotion, realistically, right? But I absolutely believe that we could build a 3-year plan to be the best community club in the country. And I think more, and perhaps more radically than that, is we're going to be a non-profit anyway. So let's look at the structure. Could the club be a CIC? If the club is a CIC and goes B Corp and places impact above everything else, then suddenly you've got an opportunity to attract completely different money, right?
This is totally speaking our language.
There are people. As you know, this money. Is totally what I totally advocate for all of that.
Yeah.
Massively Sav, so. And yeah, Sav. I'm going to point it.
Sav, yeah. Carry on, mate.
No. So there are good people giving, you know, family trusts or businesses or foundations or whatever. There are good groups giving significant money to organisations that deliver impact, and they, you know, family trusts. They will say, right, we focus, for example, on youth development, right, and people with barriers to employment, right, and then within their terms, it says that, you know, when they put a pound in, they want to see £8 back, right? Well, guess what? They could do that through football, because football can deliver that impact because the badge is so powerful. So once you know, is the path to survival in League One when there's 5 million average losses, and that's going to go to 7 or 8 even with the regulator, let's face it, in 3 or 4 years time, is the path just to keep getting no disrespect, but a skip hire company to slap their name on a stand for $40,000? I don't think that's a sustainable approach to football.
No, I agree. So Zab, I think we know people in the PLC, etc., for Wimbledon. Mm. How do you, and I don't think they have any bad motives, obviously, but how do you think we convince the PLC as owners of Wimbledon to go down that route? Because I think we've tried in various different ways, and I don't think we've been that successful, and I would like us to be more successful. So how do you've seen a bunch of stuff that's going on in the real world. How do we convince the PLC at Wimbledon to really go down that route?
Well, first of all, I think we're in a strong place. I think we've got good boards, as good as we've had, ever, arguably, right? So do I think that they would listen to different approaches about how to bring in money? Yeah, I absolutely do. I don't think the door would be slammed in anyone's face if people had a plausible plan, right? So would they stop what they're doing and immediately pivot to all in on something like this? No, I don't think so. But would it be worth looking at this stuff in parallel, and then taking bits of it that can be deliverable and building a bit of a plan and trying to, there are some really easy things, right? Tomorrow, we could decide in a meeting, we could decide to devote, let's say, 10% of our voice to community stuff, right? Tomorrow, we could decide to smash the player appearance figure of 292 and make it 400 or 500, right? And without causing too much pain. We could sit down next Monday with stakeholder groups and we could say, what do you think Brilliant Community Club looks like? Because we don't have all the answers. What does it look like? We could sit down with potential funders, good people who give good money to good things, and say, if we did X, Y, and Z, would you be minded to give us some money if we became a CIC? And that might be complete nonsense. Maybe we can't, right? But there are many things we could do that wouldn't harm us and could do very quickly. And there is a lot that we can talk about. But I tell you, I was at Exeter last week. I've been visiting other clubs. It's Niall knows more than any of us, right? It's absolutely brutal out there. And if we think that, just going 50+1, 50+1, great. Of course, we've got to do it. But let's face it, that's not going to that will kind of cover things up for 3, 4, 5 years if we want to stay in League One. It doesn't give us a long term plan. So I think we've got to be radical, but
yep.
But we need to be radical at the right pace.
And Zab, this is something we've talked about many times on this podcast. Is the fact that we are in a wonderful position. The way that our club is set up, the way our structures are set up, it allows us to start to have that radical thinking, to do things differently. But what it also, our challenge is, and I think, Adam, you have hit on it a little bit, is that for a lot of people, it's the football that matters. So it's the winning that matters. So it's trying to get to a point where we try and change that narrative slightly, where, don't get me wrong, I want to win every game. We all do. I want to win every game that we can. But the impact that it's making, some of those stories, and I genuinely hope that the club have reached out to you already, or you've reached out to the club, because I think to sit down with them and go, this is some of the examples that I've seen on my walk. These are things that we could look to do. because that would be amazing.
The thing with it, Matt, is really what you're talking about, and it frustrates me a little bit, is the assumption that doing the things that Zav seen on his walk don't go hand in hand with success on the pitch, because they do.
Because it's about long-term sustainability.
Totally. It's about long-term sustainability, and it's about being embedded in a community. For a club to have long-term sustainability, you'd need to have, we're completing a load of analysis of Fair Game right now on exactly this topic. You need to have a club that is right at the heart and has tentacles and everything, and actually is out there making a difference, because at the moment councils are getting cut back, there's not much funding around. Yep. Football clubs are that hub. And it means that in a moment of financial crisis that a football club has, you get the community coming back to you because you've already put that investment in. And that sense of using the football club 24/7 for all these amazing things that are happening is where you can do that. The issue is cultural within football clubs, because there is a difference between the foundation and trust, as undoubtedly I've seen, is you can go around and there'll be some foundations and trusts that are totally embedded and they are doing the right thing with the club, and the club really gets it and gives them the freedom to do all those sort of amazing things. And there are other clubs where that foundation and trust, and I'm sure several have seen examples, sit in a porta cabin outside the main ground and are completely seen as an afterthought and have no interaction with the club. Right. And there's a complete disconnect.
And Niall, you were saying to me, in actual fact, it's worse than that to a degree, is that you have the foundations that sit in those places outside, and the club itself will charge the foundation higher fees.
Most clubs will look at their foundation and trust as a cash cow, because as a foundation and trust, you can access grants and loads of other things, council funding and so on, that the club cannot. So they bring in a certain pool of money that the club can't get. And the club will then go, well, okay, that's great. Well done, you. We're now going to charge you to use the club facilities. So that happens in a lot of clubs. So the foundation is paying the club rather than what most people would assume, the club is funding the foundation. That transaction is actually most times the other way around. So
I wouldn't automatically be against
all of it. Yeah. Okay.
I wouldn't automatically be against that, right? Because if foundations are able to get grants for space to operate out of, for example, I don't see that it's automatically wrong for the clubs to charge. I know it might sit at the headline level, might sit a bit uncomfortably, but clubs have got to, if there is money available to foundations for space, then I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing.
I think
my next bit on it, though, Zach, would be looking at the bigger picture. So the bigger picture is that there is finances available through the new financial distribution model that will be part of the regulator. So it's looking at those clubs that are doing things the right way. So when we talk about community impact, and we definitely need to have your input into what we do with our Fair Game Index on community engagement, because there's a difference when you look at social impact. Social impact is nearly always from the foundation and trust and not from the club. But what the club can do is facilitate an effective social impact program and actually do the things that Zav was talking about, which is your communication channels, your social media feeds, all of those, championing what the foundation and trust does do, which doesn't happen at all clubs. So that's the bit that you should look at your redistribution model and saying the clubs that are doing that well are the clubs that should get more financial reward from the distribution deal. That's actually all in there. That's all possible. So it's not some pie in the sky thinking. We have got a redistribution deal. We are going to have a state of the game survey. We are going to have a code of governance. All of those things need to be addressed in the new financial distribution deal. If that happens, then all the fantastic things that Zav has seen should be part of that conversation and should be amplified, because I think they're brilliant. And it's just like, this is where we have that opportunity. So making sure that the voice that Zav has put into this becomes even stronger is so important for the way we are. And we're right at the pivotal moment. I've been around like this for a while, you guys. And Matt and Adam are like looking at me going like,
We got poor Zav on. He's literally back an hour, and Niall's jumped in there and said, "Right, Zav, how can you change the world for good?"
He's doing it, though. That's the thing he's doing. It's been brilliant.
Guy, I would urge you all, if you haven't already, and I know that you know, that Darragh's not everyone's cup of tea, right? But listen to his Hard Truth podcast with Mark Stott from Stockport, right? Because Mark Stott didn't go into Stockport to own a football club. Like when he started talking about impact locally, because he's from the area, he was all about education. And he wanted to make sure that people who, that everybody in the area had an opportunity to be educated properly. And he sat down with his trusted friends and colleagues, and they concluded that actually the best way they were going to achieve this was by buying Stockport County. Right? And in this podcast, he said that, you know, maybe one day, he doesn't quite have the money to propel them to the top flight, and he really wants them to keep progressing on the pitch, right? But even if he were to leave the football club, he said on his podcast, Mark would stick around with the foundation, right? So they were another great club to visit, right? It's to but you know. Carol Shanahan bought Port Vale to boost the area and to be a community club. Mark Stott did the same with Stockport. It can, you know, it can happen. So yeah, do have a listen, because he doesn't do interviews much. Mark Stott, I think the second or third he's ever done, and he did it as part of a negotiation with Darragh over a player, apparently, where Darragh said, "Right, you can do this, but you've got to give me some time on the podcast."
Brilliant.
But yeah, there's I don't, and I also don't want I don't want any of this or any of the approach to be seen as kind of some, you know, some lefty radical thing, some idealist woolly crap, because it isn't. It's about survival. It's about what, you know, what are we going to do in 5 years' time when average losses in League One are 7.5 million or whatever. What are we going to do when League Two is up to 3 or 4 million a year? Because we'll have done our equity, we'll have gone down to 50+1, and we just need to have a different way.
That is totally the main thing. Like, because I've kind of been strong armed round to the 50+1. I think I know this is going against me now, but I kind of think I can go for that, but. But the conversations I have with others who don't agree with me at this point is like, yeah, but that is the slippery slope, because we can't, like, if other things aren't changed, we have to continue to dilute in some capacity, and I'm not prepared to do that. You know, I can go to the 50+1. I think I can understand that, but I totally agree, Zab, that it's like it's a stopgap at this point.
Yeah.
And we need to shore up a load of other things ASAP and do a bunch of stuff. And I am still slightly concerned that we don't have enough lasers on that, actually, as Wimbledon. And that, well, maybe, that's what maybe, cuts me off, maybe not. You know, from making that vote. Because I'm like, I can go to the 50+1, but if I don't see that everyone has lasers on, we cannot go beyond that for all the good reasons that we need to be owned by the fans, and all the good reasons that that will allow us to do more in the community, etc. I guess the question from Zab at this point for me to you is, like, you've visited a bunch of clubs that are not fan owned, that have, you know, these capitalist owners, etc. Yet they are doing positive things. So some may argue, well, can we not be positive with like a billionaire owner? What do you have an answer for that, as to why we should stay fan owned to ensure that we continue to be as best a community club as we can be?
Do you know what? I don't look at this through a lens of whether we're fan owned or not. I happen to think that being fan owned could realistically help us to become the best community club in the country and a guiding light to others, right? But I actually don't think that it's contingent on that. I'm looking at it differently. Whether it is an individual or fan ownership, we've got to think differently, because I don't think in the foreseeable future we're gonna give up fan ownership anyway, so it's moot, right? But I just see that for football to be sustainable, it needs to attract different money from different people in a different way. And the only way that I see that we can do it, and if there's other ideas out there, great. But the only way I see is that football needs to use that badge, it needs to use that power to deliver impact. Because I've spoken to people in Ipswich Town dealing with dentistry, right? I've seen Portsmouth using the Mary Rose to educate people. I've been there. I sat with Walsall and I've asked them to talk about a program. They couldn't really come up with anything different until I pushed them. And then they said, oh yeah, we've got this program and we've had 100 people come in last September on employability and 60% have got jobs, right? This is one of Walsall's 30 programs in a foundation that is, you know, it's a decent foundation, but they've just got 60% of people jobs. Shrewsbury Town, 350 people, and 30% on their program got jobs as a result of this. You know, there is dramatic impact being delivered, and people back that every day. They back stuff like this. It is
amazing. I mean, I think I just want to go back. I mean, I really hope. You have got a meeting in the diary with people from Wimbledon, because, you know, like, you know, this is obviously our passion. It's your passion. I mean, so to work with the foundation and, you know, like people like Craig Cope and the DTB, and to sort of put these ideas and say, this is brilliant for us as a club. You as an ambassador for Wimbledon, which is what you've been, as well as when you're walking around to 92, whether you like it or not, it's like... you've seen all these amazing things. So this is something we can learn from, and to come in and say, if we went down this particular route, if we had this as our challenge, that would be amazing. So I'm really hoping that there's a meeting with the club coming up soon to sort of just to flesh this out, because we can't dilute, we can't lose what you've just been through. On a really selfish level, on a Wimbledon level.
Yeah, I think there's a way. I think that any of us with ideas will get them listened to by the club, right? I think that if we bang on the door loud enough, we'll get listened to, right? And there is a, you know, there was the strategy document that was released earlier this year, and it was only a very on the surface strategy document, and the elements of it need to be explored, but community was one of those. And there were other things within it, and there is an onus on people with ideas, and you know, I would like to feed into that strategy document, and I would like conversations, but you know, I've you know, as you all know, you know, I don't sit there quietly necessarily, and I have approached them in the past, and I've gone in for a meeting to talk about ideas, and they're not as developed. They weren't as developed as they are now, but certainly I'd be very confident of getting heard, because I think we've got a very receptive board. I think we've got boards that need to explore new ways. So I'm confident in those people. I'm confident that it can be heard. I just want to, when I was on the board a few years ago, I kind of oversaw a strategy review that looking back on it now, I mean, I didn't talk about any of this stuff, right? Because it's kind of come to me recently, as I've seen, you know, as we've stood on stalls with DLAG and people who were in residence meetings saying no, not on their lives that they want a football stadium on the doorstep, and now they come up to us and say they're really glad we're home. I've learned so much through DLAG about what, you know, how important we are to the community, that that um, that yeah, it's given me a lot more confidence now. But there's processes, and yeah, it's down, I guess it's down to me to go and speak to them and see.
No, it's down to the club to come and speak to you.
It's based.
No, but I think you're open for it. But I don't. You know, I know people in the club listen to this podcast, even though we claim we have one listener. They should reach out to you, and you should be on the official podcast. That's what I think.
I'm sure Aaron Paul will be knocking on your door.
Just go with that. I totally think. I mean, you know, having been with them when South was doing that strategy document, there was a lot of foundation work that was in that strategy document that's come to fruition. So we've seen a lot of stuff. So it's like at that point, there were so many other things that needed to be done with. And now we're in that position where, you know, looking at how do we become sustainable? How do we embed all of that? How do we look at getting new sources of funding? And I think, you know, I've always thought that we need to really champion about how much we are fan owned and what the difference we can make in community and all of that. I think that is the way that you get people interested in our story and what we stand for, because it's our principles. Our principles haven't really changed, but we just need to really hammer that home. I think going back to when we were looking at the board, I had a skepticism at the time about how much the club bought into some of this stuff, because we tried to take B Corp through at that time, and it was like getting blood out of stone. It was really bloody hard, and people just weren't bought into the idea of it. So there's a cultural element that we really need to embed within the club that, if we take that on board properly, that we can be that great community club that South talks about 3 years' time. But it's that bit of making sure your leaders, your senior leaders, go right. Let's do this. Let's do that, because I think there is a potential. Where I think South's got that chance to do that is because South's just under 92, and you know there is an insight that needs to be taken on board. And I'm like with Adam, I'm with Matt, that the club should be biting your hand off, mate. And that, you know, there are people around, like Fair Game, will back you 100% on all this sort of stuff. But you know, there's that element of let's, you know, come on, club, let's do this. Let's just kind of really go for it, because that's what's going to get us long-term security.
Yeah. No, agreed. Agreed.
Awesome. Yeah. Now, listen, you're just back. We're going to try to take all of your evening. But I have got a couple of little things. So on the practical stuff, going back to the walk itself, which was an amazing piece of endurance. Did you have people walking with you most of the time, or was it you on your own a lot of the time?
It was about half and half, really. And I got to the point where I look forward to walking on my own, and I look forward to walking with people. I loved so many of the legs with people. It was just one stands out. It was walking into Colchester, and I was walking with Corin. Corin is head of the Colchester United Foundation. He has been for 25 years, and you found that a lot, by the way. Lots of the CEOs of the foundations have been there 25, 30 years. Ian Ormondroyd at Bradford, Joe Lyons at West Ham, the Charlton guy. You know, they've all been there a long time, and seen a lot of change, but. I had somebody walking with me who's an Ipswich Town fan, who lived in Hong Kong, and he was over partly to do this walk, right? I observed Corin from Colchester talking to Clive from Hong Kong. Clive ran a rugby foundation over there called Kowloon Cares, and just seeing the two of them spark off each other and then so many other conversations like that you just wouldn't have necessarily put these people together. But the walks were amazing. I mean, I said a number of times, you know, you meet people, you might have 10 minutes in the corner of a busy pub and it's noisy or whatever, but you've got 8 hours walking with them. That was awesome. And then when I was walking on my own, it was great. I thought at the beginning I'd be listening to books and loads of podcasts and stuff, and I really didn't. I was just very, very present, and taking it all in It was. I listened to nothing really.
Oh, my, it was amazing. And I guess my last question before I let you go, I think this is the one that on most people's minds is, what the hell did you do in Bletchley?
Right. So you'll notice that there wasn't much social media that day.
Yeah.
There was a bit of a social media blackout. I wore black, not orange, and I did my video from the Isles of Asda. And I had my one picture taken at the ground in case anyone ever challenged me by a Sheffield Wednesday fan. So I just let it go. I let it go through. I mean, it wasn't the most glamorous of days. I walked from Luton Town Centre up the busway to Dunstable and beyond onto Milton Keynes, to the ground that I didn't want to be at, but then was thinking, well, hold on a second, the EFL have kind of been supportive and I can't be, you know, I can't just, you know, not go or whatever. I can't, you know, but I didn't enjoy that day, but I did it with minimal attention as there was no social media on that day.
Yeah. Okay, well done, Zav. That's a correct answer.
Yeah, and I got given a lovely shirt, by the way, at the club, an orange shirt saying "Walk 91."
The one thing I was going to ask in terms of like, because obviously originally you had someone else who was going to do the walk, and then suddenly you're in the walk, like, and I'm not very fit at all. What did you do in terms of do any training? Because you were literally, you're walking 23 miles a day, which is almost a marathon. I have done that when I was like 17 or something. I can't imagine doing that now. Did you do any training? How did you prepare?
I did. So I got in touch with a girlfriend of a mate of mine who's a ultra marathon runner, Vonnie, and she gave me an 8-week program. And I started and I followed it for the first few weeks. But basically, I was 4 out of 5 weekdays, I was walking 2 to 4 hours. And then at the weekends, I was building up. So by the end, I did 2. She was very keen that I would do on the Sunday what I did on the Saturday. I just got to gallop and do it again. And by the end of that 8 weeks training, I was on 20 hours. I was on 20 miles and 20 miles. And then I got loads of advice for during it in terms of, you know, I need a massage every day and I need to do these stretches and those stretches. And I completely ignored all of the advice. and all nutrition advice was ignored. I ate crap for 92 days. But lost weight, carried on going. I started just shy of 20 stone, right? Not doing any exercise until the training. And I managed to do it. So it made me think that, you know, I'm not special. I just kind of got up in the morning and just got on with it and did it. And it actually gave me great excitement. The fact that other people could do it as well, you know, it was just being on your feet for 8 hours, 8 hours a day.
I think that's absolutely amazing because I kind of had a hint that that may well have been the case. And I think that if people really want to do something, they can just do it. And you've proved that. You've literally, like, a little bit of training, very little. It's like, but you were motivated. And like you said, you had no moment where you thought, I'm going to give up.
No, I really didn't.
That's amazing.
There was a couple of occasions in week one, right, where days 2 and 3 were just absolutely brutal. Day 2, chucking it down with rain. I had my rucksack. We used Komoot, not Google Maps. We were going through fields and trails didn't exist and stiles you couldn't get to. Yeah. And we got to them and they were broken and all of that. And then day 3, I got pulled up by the South Wales police because I was walking on the wrong road. I did 29 miles instead of 27. It was hideous, right? And I got in touch with one of the physios who I've been to see beforehand, and I said to the physio, I said, look, you know all those stretches you gave me beforehand, I said, I can't really do any of them because they involve standing up. Can you give me stretches where I can just lie on my back on the bed? And I ended up with 2 stretches. One was pulling my toes towards me with a towel, which I could just about do. And the other one was windscreen wipers, where I was lying on my back, lifting my knees up and doing them left and right. And then there was the lady in the hotel who there was a sign in the bathroom, because I was staying in very cheap hotels. Basically, my brief was the cheapest hotel that was unlikely to have a riot outside it. And the lady kindly brought me up two bottles of water. She knocked on the door, and I tried to get up and open the door, but I couldn't put any weight on my feet. I just had to sit down back down the bed. Because at the end of each day, I was basically losing any movement in my legs for the first few days. It was quite harsh. Yeah, probably didn't do me a lot of good in those first few days. I thought I was getting shin splints, and I had just outrageous blisters from that day two in the wet. And it was every time I was walking, I had a blister on one of my feet that was kind of Mars bar size. Modern Mars bar size.
Fun size.
It was a blood blister, but every time I put that foot down, it was very, very sore. But if I can do it, loads of people can do it.
Oh, Zav, I mean, you are a hero.
Yeah, I was going to say. So, in terms of if people want to donate to this. Like, how long have they got until the window closes, and where do they go to donate?
Well, I'm going to keep it open for a long time, because as I spend the money, for example, on Sports Bank, I want to show people what it's being spent on, and I want to hopefully encourage them to get involved, even again if they've already donated. Right, so it's on walk92.com. But as important as that is, I can't do this alone. I can't shine a light on my own on what people are doing. I need everyone around me everyone who's kind of followed this journey to, I'm going to keep sharing content. I'm going to keep sharing programs that Sport for Good organizations are doing. I'm going to write the book. I'm going to launch a podcast.
Oh, awesome.
There's a Sport for Good event, hopefully in June next year in the Midlands. I want to keep shouting about it, but I need loads of people helping to amplify that message, because I want that 30% awareness figure to rocket. And they deserve it, because they're doing some incredible work. And we haven't even mentioned really our own foundation, right? And it was lovely to go to Plough Lane and speak to Lana, who I think is fantastic. Foundation have got some wonderful people. Of course, DLAG tend to get a lot of the attention a lot of the time, but the foundation are great too. And I think that I was really pleased to see Aaron Paul do that interview with them on the official podcast. Yeah. And it's not going to get loads of listeners initially, and it's not going to get loads of interest. But we've got to keep work. We've got to keep showing. They're doing some fantastic stuff. As DLAG are, and I just want, let's start with all knowing ourselves.
Yeah. Oh, mate, absolutely, absolutely fantastic. I know Niles has had to drop off now, mate, but cool. and we should let you go. But it's been fantastic. What? How much have you raised so far? What's the figure at the moment?
Well, 57,500 in total, including offline donations. So it's decent. It's about 30,000 of that is my sponsorship. So, including offline, so DLAG, Sports Bank, and the Street Soccer Foundation.
That is amazing. And have you got many more interviews coming up over the next week? Are we going to be seeing you in places?
I did Radio 5 this morning, and I really enjoyed the Sport one. But I'd really like to get something. I'd like to sit on a sofa somewhere on one of the big ones and talk about it. Just not for any kind of vanity sake, but I just want to get the message out there, and I want it to be heard by as many people as possible.
Yeah, well, you've got at least one more listener through this.
Exactly. I was going to say, being on 5 Live is pretty big to be.
I had a couple actually on 5 Live, but the TalkSport one was like 7 minutes. I had loads of regional telly, regional radio, BBC stuff, was good. And sometimes they'd let you talk for 7, 8, 9 minutes. So, and then I'd get stopped and kind of, you know, like Lincolnshire was on the telly, and this lady pulled up her car and she went, "Hey, are you the walking guy? Are you the walking guy?" And, said, yeah. And she got out and said, "Oh, can I have a selfie?" And she went, it's like, this is the country lane near Grimsby.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
I mean, based on all of this, we got to figure out a way to get you in the Guardian. Maybe George Monbiot will have some sort of inroad, surely. It's got to be.
Yeah, well, think about who you know and you know, gets in there.
Yeah,
definitely.
Oh, Zav, it's such a pleasure to talk to you, mate, and so good to see you well and back. Cheers, and we look forward. We are so looking forward to seeing you at Plough Lane. That's right, we might see you next week at Bromley.
Yeah, good stuff. All right, great chatting, guys. Thanks.
Take
a lot.
Good care. See you soon. See you later. Take care. Cheers.
Bye bye. Bye.
Oh man, that is the amazing Xavier Wiggins there. I hope you've. Dear listener, I hope you've enjoyed the show. We haven't really had a chance to talk about the pub quiz, and we can't go on too long, Adam. It's just now me and you. But just to say, we represented last night at the same old Wombles, and it was myself and Adam, and we had our football guru, Tool Mark. He was with us. Can't be here, obviously, this evening. He's at a Suzanne Vega gig at the Royal Albert Hall. You know, which is the age we're at now.
I don't think there's a ton to say about it, actually, other than it was a fantastic event. It was absolutely rammed at the back of the Alex. We were dragging in tables and chairs. And I think everyone had a really wonderful evening. I know a ton of money was raised for the first team squad, a couple of grand. And I think everyone who's been involved in the We Are Wimbledon Fund was really... buoyed by the fact that there were so many people there and so many people had a great time. I think that's the main thing.
I mean the fact a pub quiz raised a couple of grand is not a bad thing, really. I know there's a lot more things and a lot bigger things that are going to be coming out of the We Are Wimbledon Fund, so which is
I
brilliant.
Think it's also it spurred everyone on in terms of people who are interested in that fund to be like, okay, we can this is people are really excited about this, we can do stuff. You know, of course, there's a continued joke that a couple of grand will pay for one sock for a player or whatever. But you know, it was so cool.
Yeah, and we did as a team, we did as well as we could. I mean, we had there was a member of our team who shall remain nameless, who and in the WhatsApp group he'd agreed to be on our team, and
he totally
got to
agreed,
and we'd sat down with him, but he jumped ship and he. Appeared on the winning team, and the fact that there were two Don Trust board teams, and they came first and second. Some people would say that was a fix. Some people say they maybe had access to the answers or whatever it is. We're not that sort of people to say that. We're not that petty.
No, I'm saying it was a fix. It was a fix.
To say that sort of thing. You know, one of our former members went and joined them, and you know, fair play to them. Fair play. If that's the way you want to win things, fair play to you, I say. But it's been a fantastic evening. It's amazing talking to Zav. What a guy. And go on to walk92.com, donate if you can, and donate to the We Are Wimbledon Fund. But, you know, we always say this, if you can, do. If you can't, don't. But we can make, I think it's just amazing what the people in our club do, and we are making a difference to people's lives, which I think is incredible, not just through that football.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, even if you can't donate, if you happen to listen to the podcast, just think about the wonderful things that a football club can do and you've heard of. And that, even if you just think about that and say, actually, there's awesome things a football club continues to do for its community. We've heard it.
Yeah.
And that to me is amazing. Like, that's why I love football, because I love football because of scoring goals, etc. But man, we do some cool stuff.
We do. And now, because Toolmark's not here, and I don't want you to mess about with Adam, we can officially close this podcast down. Thank you, Adam. Thank you, my friend, Al Cooper. Thank you very much, Xavier Wiggins. My name is Matt Cooper. We're the same old Wombles. We're back.
I've been standing here since many years ago. my skin for as long as I have known.